we need to do a better job of really thinking about how students learn, assessing whether their cognitive abilities have improved, and colleges need to own that and identify the gaps that they're seeing and then help students get better at it.
This is Can Do, a podcast that explores the business lessons essential for success in these volatile times. Can Do shares the insights of industry experts, along with the experiences and advice of local businessmen and businesswomen. Whether you're a business owner, an entrepreneur, or your career is affected by the current economic climate, these lessons will give you the guidance you need to make informed decisions about your future. I'm your host, Arnie Sherman. The realm of higher education was already threatened by inflated admission costs and more accessible educational technology when the COVID-19 pandemic tidal wave hit. The new safety standards and increased hesitancy to attend by students and faculty has taxed colleges and universities like few times in modern history. Coupled with the shifting workplace requirements for graduating students, it is a perilous and uncertain time for all. On this episode of Can Do, we are discussing the current issues facing higher education and the innovations that can offer a brighter future. Joining us are Josh Weiner, founder and executive director of the College Excellence Program at the Aspen Institute. The program aims to advance higher education practices, policies, and leadership that significantly improve student outcomes. And Dr. Michael Horowitz, the founding president of TCS Education System, a nonprofit system of colleges founded in 2009. TCS currently includes 5 colleges and over 9,000 students across 11 separate campuses. What has been the real impact of COVID-19 on higher education? How will education adapt to the pandemic and the related recession? And can U.S. colleges and universities produce the skilled workforce that industries require? This and much more on today's episode of Can Do. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parsons, Bailey & Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. Good morning, Michael and Josh. Michael Horowitz is joining us today from his office in Chicago, and Josh Weiner is joining us today from Washington, D.C. Josh, tell us a little bit about the College Excellence Program at the Aspen Institute.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Arnie. Good to be with you today. So the College Excellence Program was started a decade ago with an understanding that higher education in our country is key to talent development and to economic mobility for individuals. We need the talent to fuel industry and fuel democratic participation in our society, and we need to make sure that individuals can work hard and advance themselves through the skills that they gain through higher education. So what the College Excellence Program does is we identify the best colleges in the country, those that are achieving high levels of student success, and we then work hard to replicate those practices nationally.
And for our listeners that aren't familiar, tell us a little bit about the Aspen Institute itself.
Yeah, Aspen is a national and even international nonprofit organization that works to advance values-based leadership, people who are working towards mission in business and higher education and energy and the environment and a variety of sectors. And we also work to grapple with really difficult problems that our nation and our world are grappling with, including issues related to higher education, K-12, and some of the other sectors that I just mentioned.
The Institute is bipartisan, isn't it?
We are bipartisan. We are about solving difficult problems, and we intentionally bring people from both sides of the aisle, from a variety of perspectives, to try to work on resolving problems. We're very much action-oriented, though. We've been called an action tank rather than a think tank, because we're not just interested in having conversations about issues. We're interested in trying to solve critical issues facing our country and the world.
You must have your hands full at the moment.
Well, there's plenty to do. Fortunately, I'm just in higher education, but even in that space, Arnie, as you know, and we'll talk about today, there are a lot of challenges that we're facing.
Michael, what's TCS Education System all about?
Thanks, Arnie, and great to be with you both. TCS stands for the Community Solution in Higher Education. We're a nonprofit system of colleges and universities across the U.S. advancing student success and community impact. After 9 years leading a small college, the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, from 200 to over 2,000 students, I had the insight that small colleges, which I still classified us at 2,000, needed a bigger community. Small colleges and medium-sized colleges around the United States do so many unique things, have the ability to offer personal and community-focused education. But the complexity and cost of higher ed by the late 2000s had become impossible for most small colleges to manage. So both from the perspective of creating a community of smaller colleges and a platform for small colleges to keep their mission, their legacy, their focus, their history, but move into the future, I created a nonprofit system. We're unique in higher education, and I'm thrilled that 11 years later, we have the five colleges, as you said, over 9,000 students. All of our colleges are thriving, and we'll get into the discussion, but even in this pandemic era, they're growing and having great success.
And why do you think that is? Why are they growing during the pandemic?
So thus far, while we're not closed to younger students, our typical student across our colleges is a 35-year-old working woman that's returning to complete a bachelor's or has a bachelor's and now wants a professional degree. These are incredible students. The faculty appreciate their life experience, and the focus is on education, not on all manner of peripheral things. And all of our institutions have, as long as in the case of Saybrook University, nearly 50 years of experience with distance ed. For our other colleges, maybe less than 10, but they've spent a lot of time thinking about delivering distance ed. So when they made the decision to go online in the spring, it wasn't a scramble. It was something they'd been doing for many, many years.
Even before COVID-19, higher education was struggling with its mission. What's the general state of affairs now? Josh?
Sure. Well, there are a couple of different ways I think about that, Arnie. It's a great question. One is what students are experiencing. So the reality is that if you think about the mission of higher ed, one is, and I love, Michael, what you said, which is student success, that enabling students to achieve what they need to advance their lives and help our society move forward. But students are struggling right now, and their families are struggling as well. They're learning online. Some of them have the equipment to do that, others don't. But frankly, our systems for online learning at most institutions have not advanced as far as they need to advance. Students need different spaces in which to learn. They're not on campus. They've also lost income. A lot of the students at community colleges and regional public universities especially have lost their jobs. They've lost levels of income. Their ability to pay for tuition is compromised, but also just, you know, the evictions that are happening right now. So they're struggling. And so what it means for colleges in meeting their mission is that they've got to do more for students to enable them to succeed. They've got to deal with their academic challenges in online learning, and they've got to deal with the non-academic challenges. The second way of thinking about it is that as colleges have more demands to help students, their revenue streams have been compromised. Students are struggling to pay tuition. In some cases, they need more aid. States, if you're a public institution, states have seen a diminution in tax revenue, so their ability to contribute to higher education has been compromised. And then finally, if you're a residential college, you've lost a lot of income from room and board for students who may have chosen not to come back, or if you're closed, can't come back. And so what we've got are more demands for student services and student support with less revenue. I would agree with Michael that the colleges that are delivering value are seeing increases in enrollment and holding on to enrollment. But we can talk a little bit about how colleges deal with that. But it is a difficult time for higher ed and meeting its mission.
I would add that, Arnie, we don't really have a higher education system in the United States. You know, we have ecosystems that are very different. We have the community colleges that are public. We have for-profit institutions. We have big public university systems that consider one campus top tier and others, whatever they define, is not top tier. We have many, many, I think you noted in one of our exchanges, over 4,000 private nonprofit institutions as small as 50 and institutions as big as tens of thousands of students. 100 of them are super rich. They're going to go through the pandemic fine. And as Josh suggested, many of the others are scrambling. And in our case, we have really benefited from not having residential life at any of our colleges. Our buildings, our infrastructure are focused on education and student service. So it is very terrible at the moment for colleges that had a lot of revenue from non-tuition income, like residence halls, like food. And we can have a discussion about whether colleges should even be in that business. It doesn't sound very connected to education when you think about it.
So I want to talk about content for a second, on top of all of these other disruptive forces that are happening now. You know, the higher education model that's been in use for 500 plus years has had a focus on subject matter competency. Has that become obsolete?
So, Arnie, I think it is true that subject matter competency has mattered in a lot of fields, and it remains relevant in some fields. So in undergraduate school, engineering, nursing, architecture, these are degrees that are directly related to jobs immediately after undergraduate school, where the technical competencies, I mean, which of us wants somebody who's going to be an engineer building a bridge that can't stand up when we drive across it, right? Those technical competencies are critical. It is also true that liberal arts colleges have focused on metacognitive skills, things like critical thinking, communication skills, teamwork. And I think that that has been something that liberal arts colleges have focused on for a long time. And by and large, the model was that in graduate school, you're going to get your technical knowledge in law or medicine or other fields. So I guess what I would say is that for a long time, we've blended these ideas of technical versus metacognitive skills, and both matter today. I think that there is work that we need to do a better job in higher education with some of the metacognitive skills, the lifelong learning skills, the soft skills, professional skills that are needed alongside technical skills. So there's lots of ways we can get better at that. And in that sense, I think that higher education has some changing to do.
As Josh said, in many fields, and our colleges have those fields like psychology, social work, law, the profession defines skills and knowledge that is needed. You have some room to experiment, but not a whole lot. It's defined by the professional field. In terms of what Josh is calling metacognitive skills, I think there's been a lot of slippage and a lot of incoherence has developed over the years. I was pleased as an undergrad to go to Columbia and have a core curriculum. Someone had thought about a group of courses that made sense to develop writing and critical skills. In many colleges and universities today, it's two from column A and three from column B. And no one is really thinking about, has the student learned to critically think? Can they write better than when they started? So I think there's a lot of room for improvement.
Josh?
Yeah, I'd like to echo that. I think, you know, we've made a lot of advances in cognitive science and understanding how adults learn. And unfortunately, those things have not been adopted wholesale within colleges. We still have too much lecturing from the front of a classroom. Students don't apply what they learned quickly to real life scenarios. Disciplines are not blended enough. We're not solving problems in the classroom as much as dealing with theory. Again, these are overgeneralizations. There are terrific examples. I think of Worcester Polytechnical Institute in Massachusetts that's doing fantastic work in helping students study the humanities and apply it to polytechnical education. There are great models of doing this, but by and large, we need to do a better job of really thinking about how students learn, assessing whether their cognitive abilities have improved, critical thinking, is it getting better? Is reading for meaning getting better? Are your communications and teamwork skills getting better? And colleges need to own that and identify the gaps that they're seeing and then help students get better at it. There are some great examples in the country, but I couldn't agree with Michael more that we have not kept up with the state of the art in many classrooms.
Michael, has the pandemic and recession accelerated or dampened your business model?
For TCS, it's accelerated our business model. The phone is ringing off the hook with colleges that want to explore joining our system. Often, I have the sad news to deliver that as a nonprofit system, we're very unique. The wealth that our colleges have gained over time from our model sits at the colleges. So our system office is very thin. It keeps enough resources to operate our employees, our office, help our colleges, but we're not financial investors. We don't own the colleges. So I've literally had a call from a college that said, I don't think I can make payroll next week. Can you help? And the answer is always no. Between regulatory approvals and diligence, you know, it takes well over a year for a college that wants to join us to get into the system. But as I said, for the colleges that are within our system, we've had, it may turn out to be record growth during this time, because the students, our students really appreciate being kept on track. And when we said you're not going to miss a day of instruction, the professions have been flexible thus far because most of our students have to do field placements. So if you think about something like nursing or psychology, they've had to experiment with things like telehealth, telemedicine, and we've been able to keep going. For the colleges we talked about that rely on income from residence halls, they have a giant gap. I mean, imagine you pull out 20, 30, 40% of your revenue and you do not have the expense, the commensurate expense to cut.
Josh, you authored an article on college leaders shouldn't waste the COVID crisis for students' sake. What did you mean?
So we do a lot of work with college presidents around the country, and they are inundated with challenges right now. They are facing the loss of revenue that Michael just described and that we talked about earlier. They're dealing with trying to keep their students and faculty and staff safe in the midst of the COVID crisis, and that's unprecedented. And they're moving to many of their courses, in some case, all of their courses online. And there are some colleges that have been doing that for a long time, but many have not done it at the kind of scale. Very few have done it at the kind of scale we're seeing. In the midst of all of that, I think it's really easy to hunker down and try to manage the individual crises and get your students enrolled, get their revenue in, make sure that they get some level of education, and wait for the crisis to pass. What the best college presidents do is they think about this as an opportunity to not waste a crisis, to think about dealing with things that have long been challenges that now they can address. So let me give you an example. For a long time, colleges, as we just discussed, have been working, and I know many leaders who are concerned that the manner of educating students in the classroom has not advanced as quickly as they'd like. This is a time to ask questions. We're moving online. How are we going to create belonging for students when they're not in person in the classroom? And can we start a conversation with faculty about how to not just improve online education, but help all students belong in the classroom? Can we do something now in the online format to start a conversation with faculty? Let's create greater belonging in the classroom so that students show up more often, they're more present to learn, and get that work done. Why is this a moment to do that? Because every faculty member teaching online is experiencing concerns about student sense of belonging. They don't know what's happening on the other side of that screen. So use the crisis that's forced you to move online to have conversations that can advance practice now and not just be helpful during the crisis, but help create greater student belonging after the crisis is over.
I would agree with that. There's a buzzword in higher ed, assessment, which basically means you're supposed to innovate, try different things, but measure the outcome. And actually, the accrediting bodies, which essentially are the regulators of higher ed, you can't really operate a college or university in the U.S. without being accredited, insist on it. At the same time, it's very underutilized. So surveys are given out. But that kind of in-depth measurement of are the students learning, are our experiments yielding results, it's not done enough. And this is the time to double down on it. Ironically, moving everything online allows for easier collection of the data because all the student and faculty activity is present.
Has higher ed finally come to terms with students as customers?
That's a great question. It's been debated for a long time. And I think there's an aspect where students are customers. I've never gotten fully comfortable with the idea of pure customer. Same as in healthcare, I'm a clinical psychologist. And I don't know that I want to view a student as dictating what needs to be learned. There has to be room for faculty expertise. You know, we had an interesting experiment in this country with for-profit higher education. They kind of blew open that hole. And they said, we're going to treat students as customers. And they did pick up on the fact that nonprofit higher ed was slow to respond, unresponsive to different typical customer needs. At the same time, I think by and large, they took advantage of it and didn't follow on. They gave great customer service on the front end, bringing in the customer. Then the product was subpar and we're left with incredible student debt and so many students from those institutions that never completed, which parenthetically, that's the biggest tragedy in American higher ed, students who borrow money and then never finish the degree, because finishing a degree will yield, for the most part, great economic output on the other end.
Yeah, I agree, Michael, with everything that you said. I think in many ways, when it comes to bringing students in, higher ed has seen students as customers for a long time. In fact, we have a system of higher education in our country where students can take the aid that they get, whether it's Pell Grants or state grants or subsidized student loans, and take it to any institution they want. And so colleges are very attuned to that in their marketing, in their enrollment management, in targeting the students that they think can bring them the revenue they need so they can enroll students, because that's how you get your money. If you enroll a student, you get your money. I think the really big question as far as customers go is, how do you define value? Once you get them in the front door, are you delivering what students need? And some of that students get, but frankly, some of that is within absolutely, it requires that colleges are committed to doing the right thing by students, delivering the skills and training they need to be successful in the next stage of their lives. And so there's a little bit of a disconnect here where customers, look, we've got 4,000 colleges, as you pointed out at the top of the show, Arnie, and each of those has on average 100 or more credential programs. So what customer is going to be able to figure out 40,000, 50,000 degree programs in the country and make decisions on that? You're choosing a college, but we know from the research that what program you choose matters as much for your subsequent success as what college you choose. And so on some level, colleges are selling the trappings of college, you know, the how good do the dorms look and the classrooms look and the equipment that you're going to be working on, how many, you know, for the elite institutions, how many Rhodes Scholars and you know, advanced practitioners do we have working at this institution? None of those things actually signal that the college is delivering what students need. So I think it's got to be a combination of students coming to college because they believe they're going to get value and institutions owning that value. And I completely agree with Michael that by and large, the for-profit institutions in our country, the data is very clear, have not delivered value. They've been great at organizing schedules to respond to what students want. They've been great at putting faculty in first year courses who have the best chance of retaining students. There are some really good innovations in for-profit colleges, but what they have not done by and large is delivered the value that students need and that our society needs so that our businesses thrive.
I think 10, 15 years after the boom in for-profit higher ed, nonprofit absorbed those lessons. So Arnie, I've no doubt if you inquire on the website of many colleges, you'll be called within minutes, certainly within hours. So that responsiveness is there. The harder thing is what Josh said, are we getting students completed and does the education have relevance and value?
We are speaking with Josh Weiner, founder and executive director of the College Excellence Program at the Aspen Institute, and Dr. Michael Horowitz, the founding president of TCS Education System. Support for this episode of CanDo is provided by Montana Rail Links, committed to safely delivering transportation solutions to their customers. Additional support comes from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And Parson Bailey and Latimer, a regional law firm with national expertise representing the interests of Montana entrepreneurs and businesses. More information at ParsonsBailey.com. So we've talked a lot about the challenges of higher education and some of the issues that they're currently facing. What's working and what's good that's going on?
So a few things. First of all, the history of the 20th century is the history of advancement of the United States due in large part to what colleges and universities did to develop talent. It's been documented by researcher after researcher that the United States as a whole advanced during the 20th century because of the expansion of higher education, by and large after World War II, and that the communities that developed talent the most are the ones that have thrived. And why is that? It's because we have 4,300 colleges. We have the best college access, or nearly the best in the world. Two-thirds of all Americans go to some sort of post-secondary education during their lifetimes, whether that's a technical credential at a community college in welding, or it's a PhD at the University of Montana in sociology. And by the way, that access has extended to low-income students and to students of color more than we've seen in other places in the country. And we should own that and honor that. It has yielded the growth of the United States. We are a talent economy. And as we've moved away from being a manufacturing economy, the talent that's developed, the innovation that's enabled is phenomenal. The second thing that we've been doing lately, I think in this century, is advancing student completion. It's not moving as quickly as we want, but I think we woke up around the turn of the century to the idea that access wasn't enough. And what we've been working on for the last 20 years in very focused ways is getting more students to complete. And the data are suggesting that we are making advances. We're moving from somewhere in the high 50s in completion into the 60s. Community colleges especially, which I do a lot of work with, have moved substantially their graduation rates for students. And as Michael says, that is correlated with student success, but also that means that they've gotten the degrees they need to bring the talent into the workforce and other sectors of our society that we need. So I think on both fronts, we should be really proud of what we've accomplished. And what our work is about is not being critical of higher education just because we want to talk about all the things that don't go well, but how do we build on that strength to be even better?
Higher education is a great force for economic and social mobility. And our colleges have many students who are first generation, they're immigrants or children of immigrants. And maybe the generation before is working for minimum wage or near minimum wage, and now achieving a professional degree, whether it's counseling, psychology, law, nursing, it vaults them economically. It changes their view of the world. It changes opportunity for their students. I would add that in addition to working on completion, which I think is absolutely critical, we have to be more open to experimentation and maverick programs and institutions. Every one of our colleges that have a unique professional or community twist. Established higher ed said, we don't need these institutions. We're fine having, you know, big universities, ivory tower. We don't need startup institutions. We need more small institutions that can move quickly and maneuver quickly and create programs and assessment tools quickly.
You know, it seems that digital education and artificial intelligence, machine learning, all these things that are being heavily relied on now during the COVID-19 pandemic, they kind of miss the accidental creativity and innovation that happens on a campus. How do you make up for that?
We need to spend more time training faculty on how to do that. It isn't as simple as yesterday you taught in a physical classroom, today you turn on the Zoom camera. So you have to think differently about creating audio and video and interactive and training and providing the tools. With that said, I'm a big fan of what I call hybrid. So even for our online programs, I really like, when possible, bringing students together, even if it's for a weekend. And many of our graduate programs do the maximum that they can in an online format, and then students come in for a series of weekends. Because you're absolutely right, there is that quality that comes over having dinner or lunch or interacting in the hallway that is going to be harder in a two-dimensional space. At the same time, we shouldn't take as acceptable, just turn on the Zoom camera and now you have online education.
Yeah, all great points, Michael. The reality is that we haven't advanced the technology enough. If you look at what's being created online, that's being posted on YouTube, and my brother teaches at a music school, at Berklee School of Music, and you know their capacity now to generate music being done. You know, how do you work with a student who's studying the piano when you aren't in the same room and you can't be at the same piano? You can do that, but we need to advance the technology to enable that to be done. And the invention is phenomenal. The problem is we haven't applied it well enough. The notion about hybrid is exactly right. A lot of colleges have been in recent years flipping the classroom. One of the things that we've done for many years is you come into a classroom, the teacher lectures, maybe you ask a few questions. There's no reason you shouldn't be able to get that content online. What's important about the in-person experience is the interaction, the problem solving, the exchange of ideas among students and the faculty member, so that you can advance your critical thinking, not just be a receptor for information. So I think that the blended approach, where we're providing people with content online that doesn't require interaction or where they don't benefit as much from interaction, and using classroom and in-person time to develop those metacognitive skills we were talking about, the critical thinking skills, communication, teamwork skills.
It seems that that blended approach is also what's happening in the workplace. You can't just have everybody distance working and try to have the same kind of business collaboration and business innovation that happens when you're all working together physically.
I just want to say, and this is where, you know, Michael and I have been agreeing on everything, but the one thing that I would say, this is where residential college experience has some value, which is that what happens away from the classroom, in clubs and in the dining halls and a late night in the lobby of your dorm, really does advance people's knowledge and relationships and connection to the college. It's not that that's the only model. And by the way, fewer than well under half of American students are engaged in that model. But I wouldn't want to throw that out.
I'll disappoint you and agree with you even there. I think we've gotten away from being intentional, though. So I've seen many small residential colleges where sports and activities are critically important. They're almost as important or more important than the curriculum. We've let too many college experiences, though, become about drinking and hanging out. I mean, we have an epidemic of alcohol use at a lot of college campuses, and we've decided for a variety of reasons we're not going to address that. We're very lucky with that older working student. We don't hardly have any of that. But I think you're absolutely right. But again, there has to be thought and intention. You know, we're going to ensure that students are in clubs, in activities, not just sort of let it go.
Great points.
Michael, you mentioned earlier that TCS has mostly professional schools in its system. How do you keep them focused on what their industries want in new graduating professionals?
Almost every one of our programs requires that students to get the degree, do a field placement. And so that is what exactly keeps us very fresh and close. So our teaching students end up by and large teaching in the urban classroom, student teaching. Our psychology students are in clinics. Now during the pandemic, they're learning about telemedicine because the hospital or clinic has gone that way. And then the faculty of the college interact with those supervisors in the field. And I think that's a model that has to be extended even further. For many of our first year students, before they get to the requirement, we ask that they go out and volunteer in different community settings. So much of higher ed can get better if we strengthen that connection with the community, with the workforce, and have students and faculty really think about real life issues.
I hear a lot from employers that the students they get aren't trained well enough for them coming right out of college, even coming out of graduate school. How do we do a better job training students for the work world? Josh?
One thing is, I think colleges need to own the post-graduation success of their students. I think every college should look at whether students are employed, whether they're earning a decent living. That doesn't mean that being a financial analyst is better than being a teacher, but both of those are better than working a minimum wage job after you've invested your money in a college education and haven't gotten through. So I think we've got to get more students to completion, but every college should own post-graduation success for students. And that means, did they get what they came for? I'll give you an example. The Maryland Institute College of Art many years ago saw that some of its students got good jobs. This is in the arts field. We all might say, why are you studying art? Well, the fact of the matter is that some students who study art thrive in careers. They are able to make a living and others aren't. And they looked into it and they found out two things. One is the capacity of students to sell their art and use technology to sell their art was one of the distinguishing factors. And the other was, could they teach? Because a lot of artists need to teach while they're creating art. And so what they did was they beefed that up. Every student learned technology and how to put their art on a technological platform. Every student understood some business skills. It was built into the art curriculum. You and I might say, that's not art. Well, the reality is that if students are going to do what they love and contribute their art in society, they also need to be able to make a living. And so the Maryland Institute College of Art didn't shy away from that. They didn't say that's not art education. They built business skills, they built teaching skills into the curriculum. And what they saw was more students succeeded in the workplace after they graduated. That's the kind of ownership we're talking about. It doesn't mean that everybody goes into business, doesn't mean that everybody goes into finance or healthcare, but it does mean that everybody's getting the skills they need to apply what they love and do what they love in a way that lets them earn a living.
That's fascinating because we had a previous guest on one of the Can Do shows who talked about graduating from the Juilliard School of Music and didn't even know anything about filling out a tax form or doing a business plan or any of those sorts of things. So the example that you pointed to is very relevant and I think needs to be more broadly expanded upon. Michael?
The city of Chicago is doing an interesting experiment with some early positive results where every high school senior has to have a plan for post-high school, whether it's college, military, vocational training. And I would agree with Josh that colleges can be much more intentional about thinking about the post-college experience. It's been kind of a light touch area, career counseling and placement. And again, Arnie, we have to do better in measuring, you know, by the way, business has been complaining for about 100 years on that. So I don't know that that's going to change profoundly. But we have to really ask ourselves, does the student write better and think better than before they came to college? Because there are quite a few young students that experience the end of high school to be more rigorous academically than what they encounter freshman year of college.
Yeah, the point about business's responsibility in this is important as well, right? Because businesses do complain about this. I think the question is, where are you getting your workforce from? And have you sat down with the folks at the college to not just say we're not getting what we need, but to be specific about it? What is it that you would like to see differently? Because the colleges that I know, that the community colleges that we work with, we give a $1 million prize to the best community college every other year. We're in the middle of the process right now. And the winners are incredibly responsive to workforce. They want to learn from industry. But complaining about it in broad senses isn't going to get you the results you need. Where do you want to hire from? Where are the partners? Go sit down with them and talk through what it is you want. What these colleges can do for business is they can then develop curriculum. They can hone in on the skills you're looking for. Is it teamwork? Is it critical thinking? Is it a technical skill? And then they have the expertise to develop a curriculum that will align to what it is that you need and help make sure that happens. My sense is colleges, by and large, want to do better at this, but we need to create the space for industry to have that conversation and to get specific about what it is you're looking for.
I would agree. I think colleges need to get out into the business community and the business leaders need to contact colleges in their communities because most colleges will absolutely want to partner with business in the way that Josh is suggesting.
What do you think the long-term impact of the COVID-19 pandemic and the recession associated with it is going to have on higher education?
I'll start with just some obvious ones. We've had a flurry of college closures over the last number of years. So the economic pressure is predated. So full stop, we're going to see more small and financially strapped institutions close. I'm really proud that doesn't include any of ours, but many colleges have already laid off staff, mostly, in some cases, faculty as well. That's going to take a long time for those institutions to recover. So I start with that. On the positive side, I think we will develop better tools for teaching students in a blended format.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the focus on online education and the advances during this time in online education will be profound. I worry a little bit that the reliance on that, absent making sure more students succeed, that the evidence from online education is that students succeed at lower rates than they do in person. But my hope is that that colleges will use this as an opportunity to add high quality online education to their blended formats, as Michael suggested. I think that will be a long-term impact. What worries me the most are the impacts on students who need higher education the most. I think if states disinvest in higher ed during this time, and the early signs are that is happening, I think that the ability for working class Americans to get a college education is going to be compromised. And I worry a little bit that if states don't invest in higher ed and don't maintain their investment, the public doesn't, that we could hollow out higher ed in a way that could compromise our ability to let working class people in our country who want to work hard, who want to get ahead in life, get access to a college education. So I worry about that, but I think it really is going to be up to the states and to some extent the federal government to bolster these institutions during this time to make sure that doesn't happen.
Last question to both of you. With your magic wands, what one thing would you change about higher education? Michael, I'm going to ask you first.
I would increase the intensity on retaining and graduating students. I would wave the wand and ask every college to commit to an explicit metric of looking at their current retention and graduation rate and increasing it by X percent. They can define how much, but for it to go up and to get it as high as possible. There's circumstances that limit what is possible in a given situation. If it gets better, we're going to have better education and better economic and social outcomes.
Josh?
Yeah, so I think early in the conversation, Michael talked about how we don't have one system of higher ed. We really have 4,300 independent colleges. And by and large, you know, the United States is different. We let those colleges decide on their curriculum, how they admit students, how they serve students. And the one variable that leads to great colleges is great college presidents, great leadership, who understand what Michael just said, which is it's not enough to get them in the front door, but we've got to graduate them. Who understand that graduating them may not be enough, but we need to own their post-graduation success. Who understand that with our changing demography in the country, if we don't serve the students of color better than we have, if we don't serve low-income students better, we're not going to have the talent we need to fuel our industry, to fuel our democracy. And so what I would say is if I could wave the magic wand, it would be that every state and everybody who cares about talent development in this country weighs in on making sure we've got the best college presidents who are committed to public mission, not just to institutional advancement, but to public mission. And that includes the boards of higher ed. You know, states by and large appoint the boards. What are governors doing? What are legislators doing? And how are businesses working to be part of that ecosystem? Because they often serve on these boards to make sure that their presidents are focused on the right thing and support them in making the changes that we've been talking about today that will enable higher education to thrive and serve what we all know it needs to do, which is talent development and economic mobility.
Michael, Josh, this has been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity, Arnie. Great to talk to you.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guests' contact information and content from all our shows. Listen next time when we will be visiting with businesses that have been directly affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm Arnie Sherman. wishing you good health and prosperity.